it to others. The entire ethical standards are so essentially in the melting cauldron and volcanic water that while my own feet shall be on the rock ledge which I feel below me, I shall not preach my faith to others. They know too, they are sincere too, they have Christ as well. Who am I here? Let me act in sweetness and confidence in service. Is this illogical? Is this a compromise? Not indeed. To abstain from proselytizing is no compromise. It may be due to a true humility. Paul's correspondent was Leonard Elmhurst, who you see in this picture sitting next to Tagore. Elmhurst was another YMCA man recruited by Tagore to create Sriniketan, or the first agricultural education college under nationalist auspices. Like Elmhurst, Paul found himself more drawn to non-sectarian social work, in his case within the YMCA's rural department, of which he was in charge from 1914, and here we see Paul together with the rural secretaries of the YMCA. Although he had been consistently voicing similar sentiments from much earlier, Paul fully expounded his theory of Christian citizenship in his presidential speech to the AICIC in 1923. Christian citizenship, according to Paul, was not simply a matter of being Christian by confession. For Europe, which was Christian, had failed to demonstrate Christian statesmanship in the World War. And even if all Indians became Christians, they would not necessarily thereby become Christian citizens. It was certainly not about seeking relief for community-specific grievances. Indeed, quoting Naren Vaman Tilak, Paul asserted that Indian Christians had no such grievances to complain of. Christian citizenship was about assuming national stewardship. It was about actively reconciling Hindus and Muslims, about using local government positions for social service in the spirit of nishkama karma, that is, the performance of duties without expectation of returns or rewards, is explicitly glossed by Paul to mean for oneself or for one's community. He said, "The sooner we get off the stilted pedestal of rights and begin to climb the rugged steep of responsibility, the truer will be our perspective of the situation and of the relative values of our various opportunities. In front of the enormous needs of our country and of the gigantic work yet waiting to be done unto her uplift, all talk of fishes and loaves becomes utterly untenable." Paul had support within the AICIC, for the organization did vote in favor of his ideas. However, the matter was extremely fraught, and in a blunt and angry message, the president of the UP Indian Christian Association, obviously there had been a territorial flip by this time in terms of approaches to community identity, the president of the UP Indian Christian Association, James David, expressed the hope that YMCA views would not prevail. "Spectacular YMCA views are one thing," he said, "and practical politics and preservation of one's very existence another." In spite of David's warning, in subsequent years, it was the YMCA views that continued to dominate the AICIC and indeed national-level Christian politics. And people with those views claimed to represent not just the views of Protestants, but of Indian Christians in general. Paul represented Indian Christians during the first roundtable conference in London, as I noted, and was replaced because of his sudden death by S.K. Datta, another YMCA general secretary, a medical doctor, and one-time principal of Foreman Christian College, Lahore. Datta came of a family of Bengali Brahmos, converted to Christianity and settled in the Punjab over several generations. He was of the opinion, as expressed to his biographers, that the sectarianism of Indian Christians arose from two principal reasons: their small number, and the fact that Protestantism in India was foreign missionary ridden. At the roundtable conferences, Datta was in complete accord with Gandhi's position, both on minorities and the depressed classes. He found his Catholic and separatist counterpart, Rao Bahadur Panneerselvam, distasteful, and deeply resented being asked to represent the Christian position as opposed to the general Indian position on anything. Datta epitomized the attitude of the successful Indian Christian politicians, national-level successful Indian Christian politicians of the mid-20th century. They may have been moderate in their nationalism, but they were extreme in their rejection of a sectarian identity. During the Constituent Assembly debates, Christian members gloried in the fact that they asked for no special privileges And from this basis, they even rejected caste-based reservations as anti-national. The Christian congressman, H.C. Mukherjee, member of the Minorities Advisory Committee and the vice president of the assembly, said that the masses of India needed food, shelter, medical aid, and good roads, not political reservations. Such demands arising from the ambitious middle to upper class persons alone. He acquiesced in the House's decision to reserve seats in the parliament for scheduled caste, but with reluctance, urging that this measure should be limited by time. For all its obtuseness, the strength, sincerity, and implications of this political vision is arguably best revealed at the level of working institutions led by such men. An opportunity for such a case study is provided by the YMCA itself, which produced all these YMCA types that the North Indian Christian leader had so deplored. In a study of the YMCA in Singapore, Robbie Goh has noted how, although perhaps because it was very successful in attracting official and business patronage, the social functions of the Singapore YMCA remained extremely limited and conservative. Catering mostly to British expatriates and a very small number of suitably anglicized straight Chinese gentlemen, this was, Goh says, essentially an organization to reculturize vulnerable white men in a recreated milieu of European society, allowing them to sublimate their desires in a variety of European sports and recreations. This racial and political orientation was radically challenged, Goh shows, in particular by Dr. Chen Su Lan, a medical doctor, Methodist, critique of the colonial government and crusader for social reform in the Chinese community. In the aftermath of the Japanese withdrawal, Dr. Lan orchestrated the formation of a separate Chinese YMCA in 1946. The Indian YMCAs, established from the 1850s onwards, functioned very similarly to the old Singapore YMCA, that is, until the 1910s, a visiting American secretary sadly noted that the Bombay YMCA, for instance, had a notice saying none other than Christians need apply, and it's basically intended as a racial message too. Until the 1910s, when a radical transformation took place in the composition, management, and social functions of this organization. This transformation was closely correlated with the appointment of Indian secretaries, including K.T. Paul. In the 1910s, the YMCA in India acquired a very large number of members who were classified as associate members, which was a non-confessional way of saying non-Christian members. It also adopted an ambitious social work program centered on rural uplift, which was both an ameliorative answer to Dalit Christian poverty and a meeting ground with the nationalists, as we have seen. In 1919, the Indian YMCA established an overseas project in the form of an Indian student union and hostel in London. This was something of a personal project of K.T. Paul's, who was apparently approached by the students themselves. Paul's biographer noted that Paul wanted this institution to be a space where Indians and British people could meet under conditions of equality. This would have made it a unique place indeed, for Shompa Lahiri has described the dispersion of Indian students in London in this period, in particular over funding and housing problems, subject as they were to the prejudices of landlords, some of whom apparently were not above offering informal surveillance services to the Indian student department set up in 1909. Of the approximately 1,500 students in Britain as a whole at the time, the YMCA hostel housed around 100 and affiliated a total of 435 in 1920. The hostel was initially housed in a building rented from Shakespeare Society called Shakespeare Hut, and it was behind the British Museum. It was financed by the Indian YMCA, which also retained the right to nominate the secretary and warden of the hostel. The institution proved to be the site of an extraordinary role reversal. The several Europeans on the managing committee constantly pleading with the National Council of Indian YMCAs and especially K.T. Paul for seconded staff and money. Was this an institution of outsourced surveillance? Edwin Bevan, the first chair of the managing committee, was a professor of Hellenic civilizations at King's College and had sympathetic views of Indian nationalisms. He did seem initially a bit cautious about the possibility of unsavory propaganda by external lecturers, but this appeared to clear up And in the 1920s, the students organized lectures and debates on topics ranging from whether Indians should wear purely Indian dress when abroad, to the merits of Catherine Mayo's book, and whether nonviolence was the only legitimate political option for Indians. Soon after the last debate, though, in 1927, in which a guest speaker from the Cambridge Majlis, the Indian Students Association, argued strongly in favor of violence, the management committee required a compulsory re-election of the student committee. In response, the students demanded a new constitution that would give them 50% representation on the management committee, alleging that S.K. Datta, the general secretary of the Indian YMCA, had himself promised such a course of action. Datta was forced to issue a clarification, and the students were reminded that the YMCA's management did have to be Christian, besides having a lower turnover than students could themselves provide. The rationale of the YMCA hostel was questioned again in the 1940s by the London University, which proposed that to overcome segregation, Indian students ought to be housed with other students, while the YMCA Indian Students Hostel could evolve into an international hostel. The Indian National YMCA strongly rebutted this proposal, arguing that segregation was due not to the hostel's policies, but the attitudes of British students, for whom a third of places had been kept from the very beginning with note takers. Clearly then, the Indian YMCA of London was no India House. That other student hostel which housed the subsequent revolutionary terrorists Shyamji Krishnavarma and V.D. Savarkar. On the other hand, it appeared to be a physical, social and cultural haven for Indian students in London, where they could escape the position of being a marginal and misrepresented minority and feel sufficiently at home to be self-reflexive, for example by discussing difficult Indian social problems without embarrassment. What is remarkable is that this ambassadorial institution was run by Indian Christians, minorities in India themselves. Rather than run a community self-help organization, as minorities may be expected to do, the leadership of Indian Christians felt themselves more fit to play the role of selfless servants of the nation as a whole. So to conclude, selflessness as a political orientation inevitably reeks of false consciousness or of hypocrisy. And yet, in explaining the apparently conservative disavowal of rights-based feminism by many women activists in modern India, Rachana Mojumdar has pointed to the affirmation of tyag, or sacrifice, as a virtuous act worthy of modern women who are authentically Indian. She has argued forcefully that such illiberal claims of virtue enabled both social critique and political empowerment. In an unusual reversal of gender roles, elite Protestant Christian men in 19th and 20th century India attempted to similarly construct virtuous political selves by denying the boundedness of their community and, by extension, by rejecting legal safeguards intended for vulnerable minority communities. Like the women activists Majumdar has discussed, they too deployed Indian tradition in making such claims. In doing so, they may indeed have empowered themselves in a certain fashion, not least by seeking and securing an activist space beyond the restrictive tutelage of European and American missions. This activist space was not restricted to the political success of a small number of individuals, but the much larger Christian social presence in Indian society, which even in the much altered milieu of today, goes far beyond the expected role of a minority community. Anybody aware of the educational landscape of modern India would recognize this point. On the other hand, by conflating themselves with their community, these leaders may well have failed to address the needs and aspirations of the vast majority of Dalit Christians, both within the churches and outside them. Dalit Christians, unlike all other Dalits, remained excluded from the benefits of affirmative action policies of the Indian government. Whether by endorsing a more restrictive view of religion and community belonging, their elite leaders may have secured such rights for them is another question. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Nandini, for giving us some insights into political Christian citizenship, which continue to reverberate in modern India today and give some background to the fault lines that remain. And I'd like to welcome you to ask questions or comment on what Nandini has shared with us.
There's a move towards Christian unity after 1947. How has that changed the scene? I mean, is there a new view of Christian citizenship arising from the unity which was then achieved?
I wonder if it's actually related to that. It's not really my period, although I read quite randomly on that. I think there's actually an intensification of the processes that I have described up to a point, which is, say, the late 1970s. And so the thinkers that arise out of that period are Devanandan, M.M. Thomas, and then perhaps more politically conscious Saral Chatterjee, whose wife Jyotna Chatterjee led the bill for the reform of the Christian Marriage Act. But I think both the theological and political orientation underwent a major change towards affirming Dalit needs and Dalit theology in the 1980s, which kind of drew a curtain over these efforts, if you like, in a sense. I think that's the context.
I have a slightly different question. Mm-hmm. I'd like you to actually specify and clarify when you invoke the word theology. And particularly on the question of sacrifice, that and selflessness that you ended with and started with, may I suggest to you that actually that is a very dominant sort of theme all the way from the late 19th century to and beyond, whether you look at the Bhagavad Gita to Gandhi. So what makes this specific to the claims that you are asserting? And how does it actually relate to, as it were, more Christian-based ideas of sacrifice?
Okay.
Right? Because in that case, if you start to specify, then I think a very different picture will emerge. Then the YMCA and the counterexample of India House don't appear as opposites of moderates and extremes in London, but actually appear as part of a unified dominant political strategy of anti, however you want to call it, of modern India.
Yes. I think there is there's very very interesting new book which Miti Mukherjee has written, for instance, about the idea of sacrifice and how that, whether or not that's a dominant theme, but that's certainly she thinks a kind of paradigmatic turn, certainly from the late 19th century. The interesting thing for me was why actually these Christian leaders in question, being the leaders of a minority community, found those ideas attractive, not to actually argue that they derived in some kind of unilinear fashion from given Christian doctrines. Their theology in more church-centered issues did not derive necessarily, as I've shown, from particular kind of Christian doctrines, where they were clearly borrowing from Sanskritic theology and philosophy to make certain claims. And I think in politics they do exactly the same. The point is why they might have thought that it's an attractive way of going about defining their community identity, which was the whole point, not to say that there is something about Christian doctrine which necessarily lends itself to such an interpretation.
I don't know.